Okay, when did you join SDS?
1967.
Okay, could you kind of characterize the SDS people you met in 67? Graduate, undergraduate?
Both, primarily undergraduate students.
Okay, what about their financial background, would you say?
It varied. There were some people who came from very wealthy backgrounds, and there were people who came from working class backgrounds.
Okay, did that hold constant through 72?
The people whom I knew, I think that held fairly constant.
Okay, what about grade point, would you say?
I really don't have any idea. Mm-hmm. In general, they were very bright. I don't know what their grade points reflected. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, that's true. Okay, what about the male-female ratio?
I don't remember. I think probably there were more men than women, but I don't think significantly more.
Okay. Well, what about the role of women, yourself and Sarah Parker?
Well, some women were very active and took leadership roles, and other women didn't. And I think that the environment wasn't conducive to women becoming really active, taking leadership roles that was conducive to them doing work, but not to taking leadership roles. And I think that the people who ended up taking leadership roles were people who were naturally aggressive and not intimidated by them.
Could you tell me something about Sarah Parker?
Like what?
Well, I don't know. I've come across a few of her statements. I mean, was she one of these aggressive people, or?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She wasn't crazy by any stretch of the imagination. But she was very active and ended up taking a leadership role and was in the leadership of 69, 70, in the latter years.
Okay, on the administration occupation 68, mm-hmm. The issue was police informants on campus. Was there, from your knowledge, was that really going on?
Oh yes, most definitely. There was quite a bit of it. Most of the groups on campus were infiltrated one way or another. And I think once we all suspected it, but mm-hmm. once we got access to our Red Squad files, that was borne out. In fact, it was true. There were.
Okay. I know DPS and East Lansing Police cooperated, but do you think it extended up? Do you have any evidence that it extended up to the administration?
To the administration, I would look at DPS as mm-hmm. funneling things, relevant information to the administration, but it went as high as into federal government stuff. It was high to the FBI, for sure.
Do you think John Hanna had knowledge of what the political surveillance?
Mm-hmm. John Hanna had knowledge of everything that went on campus.
Do you remember any incidences where you actually found informants in one or a couple of meetings? Or?
There were a number of people whom we suspected, and I think the Red Squad files that we have bore out our suspicions, but there were also some people whom we didn't expect and never were careful around who ended up being informants as well. And those people typically were people who'd been arrested for drug problems and were told that they'd get their, that they wouldn't be prosecuted if they would give information. So there were a few people who...
Sounds illegal. Okay, the 68 convention, SDS. Mm-hmm. Okay, Kirkpatrick Sale and his SDS book says that the one special class on explosives, that sort of thing, was supposed to be a dodge to attract all the FBI agents and the cops. I mean, is that serious or?
Yeah.
Really? I mean, I'm just wondering, I'm reading other things that it was a legitimate.
To my knowledge, it wasn't legitimate and none of that went on. So,
okay.
I mean, I don't know anyone who learned how to do anything with explosives.
Okay, since we're on that, according to the East Lansing Police Department, on Collingwood, it used to be Hazlitt, there was a SDS bomb factory. Would you have any idea?
I lived there. It was not a bomb factory.
Really? Well, no, I had the report.
No, I lived there. I moved out, and there might have been some bombs made there after I lived there, but I can tell you for sure that bombs were not made there up through March of 1969. I know that for a fact.
Okay. The surveillance also resulted in, or indicates there was reasonable cause for the suspicion.
No. The only cause for the suspicion is that there ended up being a lot of weathermen lived there. And one of the reasons I moved out was that the weathermen were, you know, they had become weathermen, and that I just didn't like living with those people. And one of the persons who lived there was reportedly, in fact, I don't know if it's for sure, but word had gotten around to us that she had been in that townhouse in New York that blew mm-hmm. up, and that she was one of the people who had escaped from there. But as far as, you know, to my knowledge, no bombs were ever made here in East Lansing.
Okay, since we're on that subject, how about Brad Lang and the weathermen and women? Nice characterizations. I mean, what kind of people were they? What were they after? Who supported them? Who joined? Who went into the Weather Underground here?
The people who went into the Weather Underground here were primarily kids from upper income levels, from Maryland. Not exclusively, but for the most part. They were people who were very alienated from what was going on in society in general. They were your typical true believers, but so were a good number of the people who were in the progressive labor faction as well. They really believed in what they were doing, and I think they were very sincere. They didn't get money or anything from Cuba or from China or any place like that. If they got money from any place, it was from their parents at home, and I think they probably, for the most part, were fairly well supported by their parents. So that's where their money came from, and their personal funds. Some people actually worked. They were extremely bright. I had a lot of disagreements with some of those people. I ended up getting in a lot of arguments with them, but as I look back on things, however misguided they were they were very sincere. They really thought what they were doing was right.
Okay. You were at the 68 convention
mm-hmm.
here. Could you kind of, what kind of impression did Dorn and Rudd and that gang make on you at the time?
Well, very strange. I thought that Mark Rudd was very bright and arrogant. I thought Bernadine Dorn was really a character. She used to walk around wearing a leather miniskirt and black tights showing off, I mean really short miniskirt showing off these legs. And she'd get up on, that was much my only impression of her, is wandering around and, you know, just, I never saw her wearing jeans, ever.
Well, what kind of impression did they make around campus at the time?
I really don't know. I spent most of my time working at, I was fairly new to SDS mm-hmm. at that point and didn't know people nationally at all. And I spent my time working inside the union at one of the registration tables and then at one of the literature tables. And so I really don't know what kind of an impression was made on campus. I was pretty isolated. And typically, we all were pretty isolated. We isolated ourselves. You know, we would go out and try to recruit people, but at that point in time, it was pretty much just the closing together. We really didn't want people.
How many active members did you have by 68?
Well, 68 was when things really started happening. I really don't remember. I know that we had, by the 1968, there was a convention in Ann Arbor in the winter, December, I think, of 68, which was sort of the midwinter convention. And, 69, gosh, I think it was 68. And we had, besides Harvard, we had the largest SDS chapter in the country, I think. Harvard had the biggest, or the Cambridge area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then we had, I think we had something like 100 members, paid mm-hmm. with, but that grew and developed all throughout the spring of 68, and then particularly in the fall of 68.
Well, I'll get your version of this story. The confrontation with Adams at the ROTC building. I've had 5 different versions of this. Could you give me your version?
Well, I wasn't there. I was there for just a small part of it. And have you talked to Walter Adams?
I read his book. I've talked to Rick Kibbe, Lash LaRue, and none of them agree with each other.
Well, I don't remember exactly what happened. What I remember having happened, and again, often my memory could be flawed, it was a long time ago, was that Professor Adams came, as he always did, came to every demonstration, and he what ended up happening, he was really a master. What he ended up doing, he would come to every demonstration, and the focus was away from the demonstration and onto the dialogue or confrontation that would ensue between him and other people. And I remember him getting in a shouting argument with Susie Taylor, and that's all I remember. I don't remember anything else. I really don't. But somehow there was a whole range of things at the ROTC building that were happening. There was a some group from Detroit had come to play. There was some sort of benefit that was supposed to happen at some point in time. And all I remember is the aftermath, which was police just chasing people all over campus. And I remember being chased out of Circle by a police car that was going dodging trees and stuff. But I really don't remember the confrontation.
Across the grass.
Mm-hmm. So I truly don't remember. But I just remember Susie Taylor and Walter getting into this incredible argument. Walter likes to say he got kicked in the knees, but he didn't.
Okay. How about the union bust in 70 during the strike? Were you there?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. Can you tell me the events leading up to that? What was discussed and what happened?
Well, the meeting, and it was a meeting, it wasn't a demonstration in the union, it was supposed to be a teach-in on racism because of what had happened at Jackson State. This was a good more than 2 weeks after the Kent State killing. So we had several hundred people who had come to this thing, and the discussions were really going quite well. And the union building was closing. And the manager of the union building came on a public address system and said the union building was closing in 10 minutes, and we're going to vacate the building. So we went up to the manager and said, can we stay another half an hour? And he said, no. Well, at that point in time, we decided we would stay until we got kicked out. And what had always happened in demonstrations today is you got 3 warnings. And on the 3rd warning, you were told, if you don't leave, you're going to be arrested. So we decided just to continue on until we got the 3rd warning. And then we had absolutely no intentions of sitting in, none. And they came in with the police and arrested people after the 2nd warning. And they gave us the 3rd warning, so of course we didn't leave. And a number of people had left as soon as the 1st warning came. That was intimidating enough. The 2nd warning, a lot of people left.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But then we were waiting for the service to get over. We're pushing to the limit. We'll get the half hour in, by making the warning.
Okay, well, 2 years later, were you there when the... Okay, after Haiphong was mined, there was a meeting in the union, SDS. I was wondering, I heard from someone else. The meeting overflowed and then the police gassed them. That started the blockade.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I don't think there was a meeting. I think there was a demonstration outside. And I don't think it started in the Union Building, but I wasn't there. So.
Okay. I've read a lot of state legislators complaining about the number of out-of-state radical students who are messing up the university. What was your impression? I mean, how many out-of-state students did you notice? And,
well, there were a lot. Probably the percentage of out-of-state students was higher than on campus at the time. But, you know, the out-of-state students were students who'd been, you know, who had been for the most part heavily recruited to come to Michigan mm-hmm. State and were, you know, your brighter students. You know, but there was by no means were they all out of state, but there was mm-hmm. a lot.
Okay, this is one. Have you seen that book by M.S. Thesis and Special Collections by Epstein?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he mentions that there's a lot.
One of the people we knew, he was a police informant.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
He didn't give that impression. I mean, according to that,
he was a police informant. He attended all of our meetings, but we all. He was a graduate student. We knew he was a graduate student in criminal justice. And he was a Vietnam veteran. He was married to a Vietnamese woman. And people were real careful around him.
Really? According to his thesis, he told everyone he was writing a thesis and who he was. Okay. Well, all right,
no,
I know.
No one trusted him.
It's just as well, it's an awful thesis. he does mention, though, that there's a little bit of stress over black anti-Semitism. There were some things going on in the local chapter.
No, that was his own personal axe to grind. There wasn't a question of black anti-Semitism. That never was raised at all. It was a question of black separatism, and there was a problem in SDS in terms of communicating between black and white groups. And I was officially designated as the liaison between the Black Liberation Alliance, Black Student Alliance. I guess they kept changing names. They had their own series of problems in SDS, but never did it have anything to do with black anti-Semitism, ever.
Maybe you can answer this. What was the difference between Sam Riddle's faction and Thomas's faction?
I think probably one was it had more to do with style than substance, would be my guess. But Sam Riddle's group assumed African names and considered themselves much more black nationalists than Richard Thomas. But you've got a resource right here, I'm sure mm-hmm. Richard will be able to give you a lot of information on that.
Okay, I want to probe this. There aren't very many women leaders at this time. I'm just wondering, could you kind of describe what was this barrier to that at that time?
Well, I'm not a very good person to ask. There is someone here in town whom you really might want to talk to, who was active in SDS, and who was in a group that split off from SDS because they felt that they were responsive to me. That's Joan Nelson. Joan teaches all the women's self-defense stuff here in town, karate stuff, and she would be a much better person, because I was very wrapped up. I never ever felt that I was discriminated against, but part of it, I'm sure, had to do with me and who I was and what my background was and all of that. And I was pretty oblivious to the other sorts of things that were going on. I think that there were women who were used and there were women who were not taken seriously. That didn't happen with me, and I can only really talk from my own experience. But I know it did happen with a lot of other people.
Okay. How about paranoia? If you had all these informants,
people used to say we were paranoid, and in fact it got to be a joke when we got our Red Squad files, and to say, well, you know, here we all thought we were being real paranoid, and found out that our paranoia was based in reality. So there was a fair amount of paranoia, and I think it was justified. So I think it was quite justified.
Did you get to take part in the trashing of Jacobson's?
I saw it. I didn't do it.
Yeah.
I really didn't believe in that stuff. I really thought that the trashing was like being a little kid and getting angry and banging your head against the wall until you, you know, got a sore head and also cracked the wall open. I really didn't think that that accomplished very much of anything except get people excited. Part of it is coming, my own background in terms of coming from civil rights movement where it was all passive resistance and that sort of thing. I believed very strongly in that. I just didn't think that the violence did anything. I was like, you know, little kid, spitting on his parents or something. And I felt the effect of it, yeah.
What happened to Brad Lang after? He was indicted for that. What happened to his gang after that, you know?
Well, there were a number of different, you know, some people became weather people, other people were off in another group that was called the Revolutionary Youth Movement. Some people dropped out, didn't do anything. Brad went off and wrote terrible spine stories. I really don't know.
Okay, well, how about let's get into Division 69. Let's kind of describe some of the ideological issues separating the progressive labor factions, the Workers' Student Alliance from the Weathermen, all that you remember.
Well,
from here.
What I remember, and this is a long time ago, so my memory might be flawed. The Workers' Student Alliance people were rather traditional, and I was part of this faction, but don't mean this necessarily in a negative way, were traditional Marxist-Leninists in there. I think they very much believed that change was going to come only from the workers, and that the role of the student movement was to join forces with working class people working factories, to push for change. And so they had summer work-ins where groups of kids got jobs, and because there were jobs then, so it was easy to do, got jobs working in factories and tried to talk about their political beliefs with the workers and win workers over to their side. The Revolutionary Youth Movement people, they believed that the quote-unquote revolution wasn't going to be made by workers, but that in fact it was going to be made by young people, and that the locus for change was with the young, with the drug culture. Also, the Workers' Student Alliance people were very anti-drugs. They were extremely straight arrow. Revolutionary Youth Movement people were very much into drugs. I don't think the RIM folks had a little bit of violence associated with them, but really not that much. The weather people split off from RIM, and they really were the ones who just were totally alienated from everything, and they experimented not only with drugs but with violence, and they really felt that there was never going to be a strong movement, that what had to happen was a small group of people was going to have to destroy the infrastructure of the society, and only when that happened would there be change. And so they were, you know, very much into the guerrilla fighting and being underground and doing, you know, what we would call terrorist stuff today. I don't think they did anything that was...
How many people are we talking about right before the split in SDS?
Oh, SDS was huge then. I know at the Chicago convention, God, and then that didn't include everyone who was active. I mean, that was just the delegates, and I think there were probably 3,000 or 4,000 people at the Chicago convention in 1969. I mean, the big old hall we were in was just filled, and that was represented. That included representatives from all over the country, and you know, we had over 100, you know, 100 members right here. I would say that they probably, well, Thanksgiving was almost 200 members here, because we had lots of representatives. So I really don't know in terms of numbers, but I know that SDS was at its peak, and whatever that peak was, you know, I don't know what sales book probably has some figures in there. I don't really know what.
Well, it's just, I mean, 200 students out of 35,000, and you can't afford to split off like that. But
well, that's true, but, you know, when people really have particular views of the way things go and the way things are, I mean, that's 200 members is a lot larger than any group that exists on this campus right now. and when those 200 students were able to turn out 4,000 people to come to a meeting in the auditorium and to turn out, you know, 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 students to a demonstration on campus, you know, that's pretty powerful. Obviously not all the people members of SDS, but
Okay, who went to the 69 convention in Chicago?
All of us, all factions of the age were represented.
What was your feeling at the time? I've read accounts of it. It sounded very confusing.
It was very confusing. I was very much against the split. The weather faction was in a minority there. You know, it was not split 50-50. The Revolutionary Youth Movement people didn't want to, at least in Michigan State, I don't know what it was like at other places, but in Michigan State they ended up going not with the weather group, but with the Worker Student Alliance group, and tried to forge a coalition that would work on this campus. I remember being terrified. I mean, the weather people had brought in some black militants, and people had guns, and there were just these horrible scenes. It was very confusing, and when I remember there being some sort of a vote that the weather people lost, and they all walked out, and then they came back in the next day and said, "We've assumed control of the organization," but they were in a minority. It wasn't a small minority; it was a rather large minority, but they were still in a minority. It was very confusing. It was very chaotic and scary.
Well, how about drugs on campus?
Oh, drugs are pretty prevalent on campus. Most of the people who were real active in SDS didn't have time, really didn't have time to do drugs. Didn't do much of them at all. There was a core of people who would show up for every demonstration but didn't do anything. They were stoned all the time or tripping or doing whatever. There were bodies that would show up when there was a demonstration. And so there was a group of people like that. But you're really heavily involved people for the most part just didn't have time.
Okay. What about the paper? I've heard that that's what went wrong with Michael Kinman and that group.
What went wrong with them?
They discovered psychedelics and mind expansion.
Well, I thought Michael Kidman discovered psychedelic drugs before the paper went under. In fact, Michael Kidman, the paper, had a very long and a rather illustrious career long after Michael Kidman left here. Michael Kidman and David Friedman and some other people got the paper started, but they moved on to other places. I mean, they didn't even, I think Michael Kidman was gone from here by the end of 68. He was in Boston by then. So the paper lived for quite a while after that.
Okay, how about the atmosphere in this here, the spring of 1970, after Kent State and strike? Describe what was going through your mind at that time. Were you worried about Kent State happening here?
No.
You had faith in Wharton, or what was your opinion of Wharton at that time?
Oh, I don't think we thought very much of him at all. We didn't think he was an evil man. We thought that once Kent, we were shocked that Kent State could happen at all. But I think it was still very far removed from us. And what mobilized people whom I talked to wasn't so much Kent State, but the bombing in Cambodia. And I think that finally there were enough people that the Kent State stuff sort of sparked people, but if it had happened in and of itself without there being that having happened in response to Cambodia, then maybe in Cambodia I don't think anything like that. You know, there were a whole confluence of things that happened all at once.
Okay, why did it fall apart, the strike? What did you
Well, it went on for 2 weeks, and, you know, there were the demands that we had for the strike were demands that clearly couldn't be met by the university, and they just sort of let us keep demonstrating and meeting, and things just fizzled out. It got close to, you know, people in midterms and getting ready for final exams and, you know, going home, and that, you know, any demonstration, if, you know, I mean, the smartest administrators just let them fizzle out, because they will. You know, Walter Adams did that. He was really good at that. Just, you know, don't bust them up, let them sit, they'll get tired and they'll leave. And, you know, sure enough, you know, after a while, it, you know, there wasn't anything to keep it going. So that's why it fizzled out.
Well, how many students would you estimate participated in the strike?
Thousands and thousands. I mean, we had a meeting in the auditorium that more than 4,000 people attended. That was went on for 6 or 7 hours, and people stayed. And you have, I mean, it's a long political debate on what the demand should be. And if you have people who stay for a meeting like that, you know, for that long, and it's probably double that number of people, you know, participated in some form or other in demonstrations. All kinds of people who would demonstrate could not sit through that kind of BS. So, you know, that is the biggest thing that has ever hit this campus and probably ever will hit this campus.
Okay. There is a lot of complaints that groups took advantage of the strike to tack on their own issues
mm-hmm.
and lose the focus of the war.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, in what ways did you notice that?
Well, it was really important. One of the things that the strike committee wanted was to have widespread support.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't want it to just be white students who were going out on strike. And so there was an effort made to approach the black students. The black students said, yes, but we have some other demands that we want
mm-hmm.
to be included. You know, free Bobby Seals and admissions and that sort of stuff. And so they were those groups, and we said, we can't agree to that. Why don't you come and raise them at the meeting, you know, and come to the meeting and participate with us in generating the demands. And they came, and, you know, everybody felt, you know, yeah, we want to have black students with us. People were feeling guilty, and they said, yeah, we'll have those demands too. So, but, you know, the university wasn't going to end the war in Cambodia. You know. I mean, the demands were not demands that could be met by the university. So, you know, how are they going to respond?
Okay. I just wonder, I can make this not directly quoted, but what kind of impression did Norman Pollock give at his speeches, when he at the rallies? Do you remember at all?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I have interviewed him. So all of his interview has to be off the record, though. He doesn't like getting people pissed off at him.
I really don't remember.
How were you active in civil rights? When did you start?
When I was in high school.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What did you do?
So, well, we had some freedom schools, and we actually, I was from the Boston area, and the Boston schools were very segregated, and I lived in a suburb of Boston that was almost exclusively white, and we had, when the NAACP organized walkouts of the schools in Boston, there were people in the town that I lived in that had sympathy walkouts. And we went into, you know, into Boston churches and stuff on the days that they had the, you know, the boycotts of the school. And then we went and participated in those famous schools on boycott days. And there were some civil rights things here in the Flinton, too. Like Flinton was a black community in Flinton. And there were restrictive covenant codes and some subdivisions and stuff. So there were demonstrations and sit-ins on that. There was a sit-in on that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Hannah supplied the buses to take everyone to jail while he was chair of the Civil Rights Commission. How did that affect his image? Do you remember at all?
I really don't remember.
What about Ramparts, 66, the Vietnam?
I that was really a hot issue on campus. He denied all the Rampart stuff, but eventually it all came out of the stuff.
Dr. Levine said that you've been through Hannah's papers.
Not through all of his papers. His papers are enormous.
I've seen some of it, but...
So, I didn't go through all of his... I went through most of the stuff on the court, and I looked at a few other things just to be curious, but by no stretch of the imagination did I go through all of his papers.
I was wondering, by chance, did you get a chance to see some of the stuff relating to student police-related incidents
mm-hmm.
and all? It's sealed off for students, so I can't get a look at it, nor its faculty. Okay. Well, James, I'm trying to think. There's one other issue. Don't know if I want to get into it, but Walzer was suggesting it might and it might not be, given what was going on. Were Jews important to the movement here, and was there some sort of anti-Semitism and all that? Do you remember it all?
Well, there weren't many Jewish students on campus then mm-hmm. in the first place, and those Jewish students who were on campus were primarily fraternity and sorority people and weren't real active. There were a number of Jews who were involved in SDS and in radical stuff on campus, but they were by no means in the majority. And as far as I never saw or heard of any anti-Semitism in any way, even from the blacks. And the kinds of criticisms and complaints, and I have a lot of black friends, a number, when the black movement initially became nationalist and didn't want the involvement of whites, a number of Jews who for many years had been supportive of blacks were offended by that. And were very upset by it and felt personally betrayed and said that it was anti-Semitic when it wasn't. And I think it's an unfair criticism.
All right, then you wouldn't say that was a contributing cause to the split.
Mm-hmm.
How much of it was ideology on the national level and how much of the split was just personality?
Both. I don't think you can divide the two. It was ideology on the national and local level. The ideological divisions came all the way down to the local level. And a lot of it was personality. People with very strong personalities, and they were bound to offend other people with strong personalities, and people fighting for control. And it's just the typical kinds of things that go on in groups. It happened in the left in the 1930s, and it'll happen in other left-wing movements, and it happens in right-wing movements, and it's happened.
Were you and your friends excited about Gorzkov being axed? Do you remember that?
Were we what?
Frustrated or angry at that?
We were angry, really angry, because he was very sympathetic.
What did you think at the time, the reason why he was fired?
Well, I think we all thought he was being fired because he, was because of his politics, because he was supportive of, radical students and that sort of thing. My guess is, looking back on it and being a little bit more realistic, is that he didn't know how to play departmental politics, and he defended some people. In addition, he did allow lots of people to take independent study courses and not do anything for the grade, which just horrified, the faculty. But by the same token, he did a lot of really good things. A lot of people got active and involved in the movement because of the experiences that he helped provide for them, including me. I went down and did some work in Ann Arbor on an independent study that he did. Ended up not having to write anything, but having to put time in. And, that's experiential, valid. But I can understand why people got bent out of shape.
What did you do? When was it, and what did you do?
was in the summer of 1969. I ended up going down and working with people in the Radical Education Project and on producing publications.
Wow, you get credit for that. Wow, that's impressive.
Well, but then I had also, in the summer of 1968, I got credit from Bob Green in the College of Education, working in a tutorial program down at Cristo Rey Community Center, and ended up getting credit for that, too. And that was, helping, poor black kids how to read. And I would go down there every day and, spend 6 hours down there, 3 days a week. And it was fun, and I enjoyed it, and felt like I was contributing something as well. I didn't have to write anything up on that either. So I don't see that it was any different from that.
Oh, that's great. Did you go to Washington 71 May for the
no.
big bust? Okay.
No, I went to Washington in the fall of 1969. I went to Washington twice. I don't remember exactly when. One, my last time going was, pretty sure. I remember the weathermen were already after them, because I remember being caught on 16th Street or someplace in the shopping district with weathermen going down the street, smashing windows, department store windows, and getting hit by some flying glass and being really pissed off, real angry. I don't remember which year that was.
Oh, that's all right. Okay, well, I think I've asked you everything I wanted to. Looking back on it, how do you look back on it now in reflection?
I wouldn't trade any experience for anything in the world. I learned a lot, I grew a lot, I developed a sensibility of things that I think is really, really good. I think the student movement in the 60s had an impact on American society that other student movements have never had before or since. And I'm really proud to have been part of it. Sounds a little bit arrogant, but it was a wonderful experience, and I don't regret it for anything in the world. I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world.
Have you seen The Big Chill yet?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I didn't like it.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't like The Big Chill. So those weren't the kind of people I knew.
Yeah, well, they're from Michigan.